You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Clifton Corbin, and this is the Earn and Invest podcast.
Growing up, I thought money was complicated, a mystery. I knew how to make money. All I had to do was do what my parents did. Learn a profession, work 9 to 5, Monday through Friday with occasional weekends, and live the good life. This all made sense until I actually started to accumulate wealth. As my bank accounts grew, I found myself befuddled. How do I invest, start a business, have my excess cash work for me? The answers to these questions seemed opaque, so much so that I hired a financial advisor and handed all the reins over to him. It was only years later when I discovered financial independence and started to study the process of making and investing money that I realized that it was all way less complicated than I thought. Well, my guest today teaches something I didn't know all those years ago. Even young children can learn the basics of wealth building. In fact, he dusted off an almost century-old series of parables to prove it. Clifton Corbin's mission is to give you the tools and skills you need to ensure your children are financially literate and ready to manage in a world where the use of money is constant. He's the author of Your Kids, Their Money, as well as The Richest Man in Babylon, Revised for Modern Times. Clifton Corbin, welcome to Earn and Invest. I want to start with a little bit of a touchy question here. Do most parents do a good job of teaching their kids about money?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Thank you so much for having me. Let me say that first before I jump into it. I think it runs the spectrum, right? Like, some parents are focused on it. I think, you know, if you've been in my shoes where you've had some financial troubles and you've recognized the need to focus on it, it might be more top of mind. But I think, again, for some reason, money's still a very taboo subject in our culture and our society. So it's not always the easiest thing for adults just to talk about amongst each other or amongst their children. So how well do they do? Adequate. So that kind of gets back to my story in that, like, I started off and I heard your intro there. I was pretty keen youngster with when it came to money, and I knew how to earn money. But with regards to learning the rest of financial literacy, that's kind of where my education stopped. Earning, saving, and that was it. I didn't know about financial independence. I didn't know about wealth building. I didn't understand about insurance or taxation or any of these other pieces that, you know, fit that financial literacy puzzle. So I think parents, you know, the last thing I'm going to do here is put parents down. Like, we've got a hard job as is, but I think they're doing as good a job as they can. My job, my role, what I try to do is provide more support so they can do even better.
I think in some ways you said our stories are similar. Coming from fairly successful parents, they modeled really good financial behavior. On the other hand, they didn't explicitly teach me about money either. Tell me about your upbringing. Did your parents teach you about how to deal with money?
So, I think it was similar in that my parents, both immigrants, came here with very little and worked hard, became fairly successful, middle class, whatever. And they demonstrated what it was to, you know, work hard and earn. And they kind of did the leveling up with homes. So they had the starter home, and then they sold that to get the next home that was a duplex and had rental income. And then they leveled up again. So I was able to see that And one thing that I'm always grateful for is that because I was so money curious as a youngster, they were always very transparent and open to talk to me and answer any of my questions. The challenge was that the questions never went past what I asked. So if I was asking, how do I make more money? They would say, well, maybe you start a business, and we, you know, work through how you start a business or all of those fun pieces. But it never went past the earning. Like I said, it always stopped at earning or saving. So we didn't get into it. So yes, they did teach me about making money. And yes, they did teach me about the value of saving money, but not the why behind why you want to save money, whether it be for an emergency or to build wealth or for financial independence. We didn't get to that. And then, like I said, all the other pieces that come with building wealth and securing wealth and acquiring wealth, the conversation just didn't get there, which is why I've decided to try to help other parents who are lucky enough to have kids and curiosity and all of the rest. I want them to take advantage of that and say, hey, if your child is asking you about one of these things, make sure you do a yes and kind of response. So you're kind of always giving them a little bit more and pushing them a little bit more. One thing we see all the time is our kids have an amazing capacity to learn and understand. But if we're not giving them all of the information, then we're not leveraging that wonderful gift of curiosity that they already have.
I want to get back to that amazing ability to understand that kids have. But before I do, a few moments ago, you said the magical phrase, you fell on hard financial times. Obviously, you had this curiosity about money as a kid, but it didn't protect you. What happened?
Yeah. So my story is, like I said, I was pretty keen on earning. I was good there. I was okay with saving. I was good there. I went off to university, got those first credit cards. You had the mentality that credit cards are there for an emergency, which I kind of lived for a little while until I didn't. And then credit cards were there because it felt like free money. And I used them almost as free money. I was not diligent at paying my bills back to the point where I just wasn't paying my bills back. And then it kind of spiraled out of control from there. I was doing cash advances from one credit card to pay the minimum balance on another credit card. And I'm sure all your listeners could probably fathom what happened after that. When the credit cards got canceled and cut off on me, went to collections. So I made a total mess of my finances. Like, I didn't have any candle on what I was doing with regards to debt. And I make sure that when I talk about debt, I let folks know, well, one, there's that side of it when you're just using it for commercial consumer stuff and it's not very valuable. But you could also, like, at the same time, I was in university, college at the time. And I had student loans. I was using some debt, leveraging some debt to, you know, further my education and make myself more employable and gain some usable skills. So I was doing both the good and the bad with my debt. But fast forward a little bit, it took me a while to get out of that. You know, the debt collectors calling me. I had all of the stress and anxiety and depression that comes with having, you know, a heavy debt load. So I finished my first degree with the tech bubble bursting, and I finished my second degree with the housing bubble bursting. So I've promised everyone that I'm not going back to school just to keep the economy stable for a little bit longer. All that to say that it took me a while to get my finances back in order, but in doing so, it helped me spend the time that I needed to understand how the system works, to understand that, yes, you can use debt, but you can leverage it to gain wealth. You know, earning is great, but if you're not doing what you need to do to build wealth and secure your wealth, then you're not really moving forward. So I was able to learn all those basic principles. One of the books, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, one of the books I used at the time was The Richest Man in Babylon, to kind of give me a path forward. I talk often about how, you know, I had a couple credit cards that were in collections, and I started paying one off. I paid the whole thing off, and it was a long and hard road to get it all paid off, but I paid it all off, and I didn't feel like I was moving ahead because I paid it all off. And I remember thinking, man, I still don't have enough money to go buy myself a slice of pizza right now. So I just worked for however many months, put all this money towards my debt, but I still hadn't started the path of wealth creation. So that was one of those changes that I made when I started paying off my future debts. And that's kind of, and like I said, I started living some of these principles of wealth creation and seeking financial independence and taking advantage of all the different parts of financial literacy to get myself on a better footing and feel a little bit more confident about my finances and just feel like I'm actually in control of my money as opposed to the other way around where my money's controlling me.
Did the book help form your turning point? So we're talking about The Richest Man in Babylon, George Klassen's classic book, personal finance book. Was that part of that turnaround? Because I'm always wondered how people go from rock bottom, right? In total debt, using one credit card to pay off the other, taking loans, et cetera. There's some people who never recover from that. You clearly did. What was that turnaround?
There was a few things. So I mentioned I was in school. It wasn't so much the book itself. It was a combination of things. It was maturing. Just, I was getting older. I recognized the path I was on wasn't the path that I wanted to be on. I mentioned earlier, I was a very money curious child, and knowing that I'm now about to finish school in debt in a pretty tumultuous economic time. I was a computer engineering graduate. So the tech bubble bursting was a big, it hit me hard in that I was like, I thought I was going to finish with maybe signing bonus and all of this would just be, it would solve itself. And then I realized, no, that's not the way it's going to go. I'm going to have to figure this out. I'm the one who's going to have to make changes. So I doubled down on my studies, made sure that was okay. And then once I finished, I got a job. It wasn't the best job. It wasn't the job I was hoping for, but it was a job that provided me an income, and I doubled down on that. So the turning point was, it was really a maturing in myself and just saying, this isn't the path I want to be on. This isn't the life I want to live. I need to make changes. So, changing my lifestyle, changing my mindset to, it's not about consumption anymore. It's really about trying to find a way to grow some wealth, because that was what I realized I was missing. I was spending, I was consuming, but I wasn't building anything. I wasn't growing. The book provided a roadmap, which was wonderful. It's one of the things that I really attribute to giving me a path forward, recognizing that if you're just using all of your money to, whether it's paying bills or paying back debt, you still will not move forward. You need to find a way to build wealth and live off of less than what you're making. And it's only that combination of factors will get you to the next step. And then ideally, you're getting your money to work for you with investing and what have you. At the time, I was more just focused on, how do I make sure that once my next debt is paid off, I have something in the bank, which was when the next debt was paid off and I did have a little bit of a nest egg. It wasn't a lot, but it was something. It did feel like I was moving forward. It was much better to know that, I'm a little bit more debt free and I have money to show for it as well. The combination is what gives you that feeling of, you could drop your shoulders down a little bit less stress, knowing that if you need to go and, get new tires for your car or whatever, you have some cash there available instead of hoping that a credit card is going to bail you out.
You mentioned this idea of maturing, right? There's a certain amount of life lived that we have to have before we can start taking control of things like our money. You teach parents how to educate their children on personal finance and their finances. How do we know when the kids are mature enough? Like, when is the time to start? And how do we instill some of these ideas so that they don't have to go through the same painful mistakes that some of us had to?
Well, if I was going to boil down what I'm trying to do, it's making sure that our children are aware of basically the financial system, making sure that they understand what money is, how money is used, why we try to get money. It's not just to consume more. Like I said, it's about building wealth and hopefully seeking some financial independence and some financial security and some financial wellness. And to do that, we just need to be open and willing to talk to our kids about money. If we're not talking to them about money, how we get it, how we use it, how they will use it, then they may still end up stumbling and making some missteps along the way, but at least they'll know what they should be doing. Hopefully they could just, go, like you said, lived experience sometimes is a better educator than any one person could be. But if they know that living off of less than what you make will get them ahead, maybe they will do it. And if they do it, then, they'll start off a little further ahead than, let's say, I did. But as far as like how old and when, as soon as they start recognizing that money is something that we're using to trade for services and goods, I think that's a perfect time to start. Like, and then, you're not going to talk to a toddler or a 4-year-old about, taxation or inflation or anything like that. But you could start with, early money identification, and then you go from there. After that, maybe they're old enough to start managing some money on their own, and maybe you do an allowance or some way that they can start managing their own money. And then you keep growing and building off that. Hopefully before they're off on their own, they had an opportunity to have a budget that they're managing Again, as a teenager, late teens, if they're managing their own clothing budget or lunch budget or back to school budget, it's again giving them opportunities to practice using the skills that we're talking about. But they're doing it in a safe way where you're there to coach and advise them, which is one of those things that, you know, I still marvel at the fact that I was able to go off, into my college years, get thousands of dollars worth of student loans and debt, and no one really talked to me about what a credit score is, what a credit report is, what will happen if you're not managing credit, what are the repercussions of having a lower or high credit score. Like, I didn't know any of that until my credit score was already bottomed out, which is, that's a miss, right? Like, if we're not at least giving our children the opportunity to understand what they're about to do and what the repercussions of what they're about to do will be on their future. Again, if you're talking to a child about retirement, it's probably going to fall on deaf ears, but you can still say, hey, one day you may want to have a car. Right. If you want to buy this car, you want to buy it at the cheapest price. And if you have to finance it, this is what happens if you're not paying back your bills. This is what happens if you have an established credit. This is what happens if you establish credit, but then you blow right through it. So you can talk to them about what makes sense for them. You know, you always have to make it age appropriate, and, you know, you have to go to where they are. But by giving them this information at an early age, we're setting them up for success is what we're doing. We're giving them a sample of what the world is in a safe environment. And again, maybe they still make some missteps along the way, but at least they have the information to make an informed choice. And if they make the wrong choice, that's okay. There's always a way to get back to it, but hopefully they can even get back to it quicker without having to fumble through the way I might have.
I love this idea of meeting them where they are. I want to use that as a chance to transition to The Richest Man in Babylon. You revise this along with your son for modern times. When did you first read the book to your children? How old were they?
Okay, so I tried reading this book to my son, I think it was last year, because I only recently revised it. So I tried reading it to him last year. We'd run out of books on his bookshelf to read. And I was like, this is one of my favorite books. I know it's not meant for children, but it's PG. It's very, like, it's, in my opinion, like, the concepts are easy to understand, and it's written in a very fun, short story type way. I was like, I'll read it to him. And I think it was like the first page or two, like, his eyes just glazed over, and I could tell he didn't understand a thing I was saying. And I was like, I've never read the book, I don't know, dozens of times at this point. And I'm like, this book was not written for a modern audience. It just wasn't. One of the things that I've noticed is, like, every object, every character is pretty much a male character. And I was like, it'd be nice to have a little bit more diversity and representation, at least with the genders. So I realized that the book had, you know, fallen into the public domain. And I said to my son, I was like, are you interested in working on revising this with me? Because I realized right away, as soon as I realized that it had gone into the public domain, I was like, I need to do an updated version of this. And then I thought, like, how do I make sure that it is actually something that he will understand once I'm done? And I was like, the best way would be to work on it with him. So I'd read a couple lines to him. And if he didn't understand what I was saying, I'd revise it. I'd work on it. And I'd read it back. And as soon as the light bulb went off on his face, I was like, okay, that stays. And we went, you know, bit by bit through the book. And I think the final product is wonderful.
How old was he when you went through this process?
He would have been about nine years old.
And tell me, how did it affect him? So you're going through line by line. So this is really clicking with him, right? Because you're breaking it down. You're changing what needs to be changed so that it'd be revised so that he could understand it. Did you start seeing the light bulb go off in his head as you were going through this process?
I feel like the answer should be yes, but I'd be lying. Like, it was. So my son, he's similar to how I was. He's also very, you know, money curious and motivated by getting more money. So the project was easy to work on with him. If I tried doing this with my daughter, she would just be like, I don't care. And she's a couple years younger, but she just has different interests than him. So he was a perfect test subject for it. Some of the concepts he got, and if we chat about it now, he still gets it. But one of the things, even though I went line by line, and a lot of the stuff, you know, you hear more than one time, even in the story, they're still kids, right? So you have to, none of what I'm saying is a single conversation that you'll have with a child or a grandchild, and you can just assume, okay, they understand this, I can move on to the next subject. You're constantly bringing it up using different references, different examples, different perspectives, and building off of what they may understand. So it's a continuous learning exercise where you're constantly trying to give them more information, and you're going back and making sure they caught the first bit. And you're just kind of like, that's how kids learn. That's how kids learn. That's how we all learn, right? Mm-hmm. Like, well, hearing something once, maybe it clicks, but likely it doesn't. Hearing it a few times, yeah. And the more you hear it and the more you get a chance to actually experience it and live it, so it will be harder for him to, you know, pay himself first, in that he only has so much money in his allowance. But some of these other stories and some of these other habits, he has learned, he is getting, and he does understand. There's been times where I'm like, okay, he gets that. I remember there was a couple months ago, we brought home some strawberries, and I think we were talking about the price of strawberries. And it was high. Obviously, inflation's still pretty high right now. And I remember talking to him about, well, why do you think these strawberries are so high? And he walked through the supply demand curve like he had just graduated Econ 101. And I wish I had it on video, because it made me so proud. Just knowing that he gets it. He's got that one is down. That one is embedded. He gets that. And other things are, you know, work in progress, but he's getting it. And the reason he gets it, the reason he understands it, is because it's something we talk about. It's something that is normalized within our household. It's not a subject that's outside of the realm of something we talk about on a regular basis. And I think that's the key, is that I don't feel like I'm forcing the subject on any of my children. It's just when an opportunity arises, like, you know, my wife coming home with strawberries and saying, wow, these were a lot more than I was expecting them to be. And then me talking to my son saying, well, why do you think they were so expensive? And then that could, you know, spawn other conversations of, well, do we need strawberries? Could we replace that with blueberries or something? You know, we could have a needs versus wants conversations or a substitution conversation. So it can go anywhere and everywhere, but the beauty is that everything is on the table. There's nothing that we are not willing to, you know, discuss and have a conversation about. And like I said, my son, I use my son a lot more in these examples just because he is so money curious, but my daughter's right there and we're talking with her as well. And she's, like I said, she's not as motivated by money, which is great. I think having that dichotomy in the household really is a wonderful thing, just to say, you know, it's not all about just getting more money. They're both very kind-hearted and they're always looking for ways to give back and help and be charitable, but it's nice just having both of them there so that the conversation is very, very fluid, because she'll throw in something that would be totally different than what he's thinking about just because their perspectives are different.
So George Klassen wrote this book almost 100 years ago, right? In 1926. Yep. And right. The parables, the stories in this classic, are about Babylon. So we're talking about thousands and thousands of years ago. How relevant are these stories today? I'm thinking about your conversation about credit cards and college debt and all these things that clearly didn't exist then. Are they still relevant?
100%. 100%. So the stories that were written were, one, they were just so, I don't know, Klassen was a genius in my mind. They were written in a way that just brings everything down to a simple lesson. Like, I already used the term pay yourself first, and I believe it was Klassen who coined that phrase. The idea of making sure that the first person who receives any of your money, regardless of what bills you have, whether it's a credit card bill or whether you're hoping to buy some cryptocurrency or whatever it is, make sure that whatever money you acquire, part of it is yours before you pay any bills, before you do anything. That is an essential skill if you want to build wealth, if you want to make sure that you're not living beyond your means, if you want, like, it's a simple concept, it's an old concept, but it's very much a relevant concept. And the book is full with other pieces like that with regards to making sure that, you know, you're paying off your debt and how you can pay off your debt and what you can do to make sure your debts are repaid. There's so many in there that I'm like, I want to say all of them right now. I'm just excited. I'm just so excited about the book. But there's just lots of little pieces in there. The funny thing is, the one thing that I felt like he kind of stumbled on was the insurance piece. Like, he wanted to talk more about insurance And again, if you're talking about Babylon, like there's no insurance in Babylon. So that was, he had one chapter there about insurance. And it was one of the chapters I always thought was my least favorite. So I just totally rewrote that one. But yeah, the concepts still play. They're still very much relevant.
I mean, and this also begs this question of, we tend to, and I talked about this in my introduction, we tend to make money management really complicated. And yet I'm looking at these parables from thousands and thousands of years ago, written by this guy 100 years ago. And it makes me think about both the simplicity and the timelessness of financial advice. I mean, is it that straightforward that 5,000 years later, or at least 100 years later, we can give the same advice that they were giving back then?
Yeah. And first, I just want to clarify, I'm pretty sure Clayson's book is fictional. So they're not true necessarily stories from, you know, thousands of years ago, but they were placed then. And if they were to have occurred then, I think it would still work. But yeah, I agree with you. I think we've overcomplicated what we need to do. And, you know, I mentioned, let's say, crypto or what have you. I say it often, especially when I'm talking to parents who, you know, they're already overwhelmed with the amount of things that need to happen, whether it be, you know, getting food on the table, getting to work, getting kids to extracurricular. There's so many things. And now you're saying, hey, how about you learn this new financial device? It's not necessary. It's all extra. Yes, you can learn more. You can do more. You can use this, you know, investment instrument versus that one. You can do as much. You can make it as complicated as you want, or you can simplify it by making sure you're making less than you make, making sure you take what you're not using and you're saving that for a rainy day. And then once you've got your rainy day fund secured, you're making sure that your money is working to make more money. And that's where Clayson said in The Richest Man in Babylon, that still applies to today. How you do it, whether you're using, you know, three envelopes or automatic transfers, or, you know, you need a budget app or the Mint app or this app or that app or this bank account or credit unions or, you know, online bank accounts. Again, we can go up and down, and those are just different tactics. Those are just different tactics to do the simple things that I just mentioned. You need to make sure you're earning something. You need to make sure you're living off of less than you earn. And then ideally, you make sure that the money that you're not using is making more money. And that it doesn't get much more simpler than that. But again, those tactics, all those different things that I mentioned, they're just that. They're just different ways to do the simple.
Clifton Corbin's mission is to give you the tools and skills you need to ensure that your children are financially literate. He is the author of Your Kids, Their Money, as well as The Richest Man in Babylon, Revised for Modern Times. We're going to take a short break. I'm Doc G, and this is the Earn and Invest podcast. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Monarch Money. Listen, a lot of you out there were using Mint. We all know it's going away. The question is, what next? Well, I think the best solution is Monarch Money. I've been using it for months now. It is easy, collaborative, intuitive. I have to tell you, I find this to be the easiest budgeting app I've ever used, and it's just so much more than budgeting. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets, track progress towards financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now you can get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/EARN. That's monarchmoney.com/earn. Why do I like Monarch Money so much? It's intuitive. I was able to sign on immediately, get all my banks and credit cards and everything connected. It is collaborative. I can share it with my wife, with my financial advisor, anyone I want to get involved. It is easy. It's customizable. It's made so that we can use it the way we want to use it. And the reason why it's so customizable is because it's customer focused. Monarch Money is always focused on trying to deliver what we all need. After trying out Monarch Money for myself, I understand why it's the top rated personal finance app. And right now, listeners of this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/earn. That's MONARCHMONEY.com/earn. EARN for your extended 30-day free trial.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, such as job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and shows you hidden allies so you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/earn. That is linkedin.com/EARN for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/earn and get started. Let me reintroduce you. We are talking to Clifton Corbin. His mission is to give you the tools and skills you need to ensure your children are financially literate and ready to manage in a world where the use of money is constant. He is the author of Your Kids, Their Money, as well as The Richest Man in Babylon, Revised for Modern Times. Clifton, you mentioned a little bit ago this idea that one of the chapters you didn't connect with as much personally was the insurance chapter. Tell me, is there anything that Clayson got wrong? Anything that you feel doesn't really fit in today's society as you read through the stories?
Great question. I would have to say the only one that was kind of irksome is the one about your home, in that I believe, like, in The Richest Man in Babylon, you know, he says, make sure your home is a profitable investment, which I don't disagree with. I just know that there's a lot more to that. It's one of those, I think that was one of those few chapters where I was like, it's almost too simple to say, make your home an investment, because it might not make sense. We could throw thousands of dollars into a home and it might not make sense, because you can't necessarily, especially if you don't pull that equity out, like, there's no real investment there. So that's one of the few chapters that I was like, I don't know, but I don't necessarily disagree with the idea of using, you know, real estate as a means of increasing your net worth. So for this project, I was like, it's his concept. I wanted to revise the language. I wanted to update some of the characters and refresh it. And like I said, I wanted to make sure that the insurance piece was a little bit more clear. But that one piece about making sure your home is an investment, that's one that I know, you know, especially some folks in the finance community might argue with a little bit.
What were some of the other departures you felt like you had to make to bring this a little bit more up to date? I'm thinking of one of the chapters at the end where there's a series of emails that go back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that was so that was one of them. Again, just trying to make it more modern. So in the original book, it's a bunch of letters that are going back and forth. And I was like, no one sends letters anymore. So I changed it to emails to make it a little bit more modern, a little bit more contemporary. The language, it was a lot of the language. I think the original book was written to be, I don't know, a little bit more literary fiction, to have a lot more, you know, verbal flourishes that, in reading now, some people love it. And, you know, for me, I neither loved it or hated it. It was just one of those things that it took a while to get into before you stopped noticing it, where they would say, you know, thou-ith and do-ith and all of these extra syllables that really add no value to the actual text. In fact, some people think it takes away from the text. Like I said, when I'm reading it, the original version, that is, it takes a while for me just to get into that flow. And once I'm into it, I'm there. But I know a lot of folks, they have a hard time with that. So I just stripped all of that out. And I think I mentioned this as well, just the characters. I wanted to make sure that the cast of characters in the book had a little bit more diversity. I wanted to make sure there was, you know, a diversity in, especially in gender, in that the original book was written in 1926. It was definitely a more patriarchal time than we're in now. I wanted to make sure that kind of got a re-looking at. So make sure some of the characters were both. And just to go back a step, one of the reasons I love the book so much, it's not a book about in my opinion. It's not necessarily a book about creating wealth, or it's not only a book about creating wealth. It's very much a book about sharing knowledge with people who need knowledge, which is something I resonate with, obviously. And I wanted to make sure that as I was going through, that the characters, both the teachers and the students, were on both sides, whether it be, you know, on wherever it is in the book. I wanted to make sure that that was also a diverse casting of characters as well. So that those are the things I think that really, you know, brought it up to a little bit more contemporary.
How do you think the ideas relate across cultures? I mean, we're a very kind of an American-centric culture. This speaks to us. Do you think it speaks to other cultures as well?
I think it would play well in almost any Western culture, any capitalist culture. It would be fine. I think, I don't know, I can only really speak to a Western culture, and that's the culture that I know best. But any culture that has a capitalist society where you are responsible for your wealth creation and your financial independence. If you had a system where, you know, you're going to receive a pension no matter what you do, no matter how you do it, it might not be as necessary. But in the societies that I'm in, that we're in, I should say, we're on the hook for making sure that when we're no longer able to go out and work and earn an income that way, that we are financially secure, whether that be through, you know, pensions are kind of dead, but whether that be through, you know, a direct, like a 401k or something like that. Having a story that talks about creating wealth and takes advantage of, you know, compounding interest and investments and making sure you're living off less than you make. Those are things that play well in any culture that leaves your financial security and financial independence on the individual.
I'm interested in this idea that Clayson wrote this at a very different time than today. And I'm wondering how you think his message jibes with today's kind of recognition of social injustice, right? I mean, we have been much more aware of this idea of racism, classism, gender-based factors that really can impact how successful a person is. How do you think his message jibes with what's happening today? I mean, in a sense, anyone who's interested in personal finance or building wealth believes somewhat in bootstrapping, right? On some level, like, you have to pick yourself up, you have to fix things. But we also realize right now where we're in the cultural zeitgeist is that there are a lot of unfairness. How do you think these messages play out today?
That's a great question and an interesting one. I think, and this is a tough one, I think the message of, like you said, bootstrapping or individualism, for better or for worse, is the reality of our systems. It is where we are. So whether you've, you know, lived through injustice, what have you, and I don't mean to downplay any injustices, whether that be structural or not, we still are stuck with this system, right? If we're in the system, you need to find a way to maneuver within the system. I was reading a book a little while ago called Machiavelli for Women. It was written by the host. I don't know if she's still the host of Planet Money NPR podcast, wonderful podcast. And the Stacey Vanek Smith is the author. And in the book, this is just to make a parallel, in the book, she talks about, you know, she's talking more about like the income gap with regards to gender, the gender pay gap. And she talks about how to work within that system. And I think I liked how she said it, in that she said, like, no one is justifying the system. No one thinks that gender equality is something that should remain. In fact, we should all be working to minimize gender equality, just as we should be working to minimize and hopefully eradicate, you know, racial equality or class equality or all of these things. Like, that's something that we need to be doing actively. But we can't pretend that the system isn't what it is right now. So we have to live within the system as we try to change the system. So with that framework, Clayson's message is, while it doesn't talk about any of those inequalities that we're just speaking about, it does give a framework and a roadmap to live within the system. So the messages still work in that you still need to. So if, regardless of where you are on, you know, social economically, you still need to find a way to find how you're going to fund your, you know, your retirement, if that's what you're working towards. Hopefully some type of financial independence at some point, if that's possible. Maybe it's not. I hope it is for everybody, but I recognize it might not be. It might not be. But we still need to figure out, how do we work within this system to get the most we can from this system as it is? But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be working to, you know, fix it.
When I talk to people about this idea or concept of financial independence, you know, a lot of the times I get the feedback, you know, that's great for people who have money, or that's great for people who find themselves in a reasonable position, but it's not really possible for all. And I'd like to broaden that conversation to some of these lessons we learned from The Richest Man in Babylon. Do you think that this is generalizable to most of the American public? Like, these lessons are things that most of the American public could strive towards or bring into their life?
Well, and I've said this in other situations, like, personal finance is personal first. And if you tell me you do not have enough income or enough, you know, means to live off of less than what you make, I'm not here to argue what you think is true or what isn't. I do know that if you're not living off of less than what you make, it's going to be harder and harder to move forward. So I don't know. I don't know what the best scenario in that situation is. Like, do I think it could apply to most people? Yes, I do. Because I really feel like you need to find a way to live off of less than you make. But I also recognize that for a large population, that's just probably not feasible. It just isn't. In that situation, you need to, but, you know, part of some of Clayson's messages are about making sure that you maximize what you earn. So I don't want to forget about those lessons as well. But if you've set yourself up to, you know, make as much as you can, you've gained the skills that you need. Again, these are lessons and messages within Clayson's book. You've done everything you can to make yourself, to put yourself in a position to reap any opportunities that may come your way. You've done that and you still don't feel like there's enough money or enough opportunity or enough whatever it is to live off of less than you make, then yeah, you're probably right. This doesn't apply to that person. But I think for the vast majority of, maybe not the vast majority, but I do think for the majority of people, if they work on making themselves as employable as possible, or seek opportunities that, you know, can leverage the skills that they have, and they do that to their fullest, yeah, they should be able to, maybe. I don't know. It's hard for me to say, because again, like I said, it's personal first, right? So it's hard to speak about the masses for something like this, but I do think there's a lot of lessons in there where it talks about making sure that it's not about luck. It's about making sure that you've really set yourself up to maximize the opportunities that come your way. I can speak from my lived experience. That's probably the only experience I should be speaking to. It has worked for me in that, like, I feel like, you know, I talked about at the beginning of the conversation how I graduated at in the middle of one bubble bursting, and then graduated for my second degree at the middle of another bubble bursting. But even though the bubbles burst, I still was gaining skills. I was still making myself more employable. So I was still able to find gainful employment. I was still able to make an income. I've been able to leverage some of the skills that I've had. I have through working. I've leveraged some of the skills I've had through writing. So I'm able to, again, just speaking about myself here, I've been able to leverage some of the skills that I've been able to gain to increase my income. That's not luck. That's, you know, preparation and practice and being a lifelong learner. That's, again, I'm just speaking about myself here. But I, you know, that is one of the principles that's talked about within the book itself as well. So it's unlikely you wouldn't be able to find something in that book that could help you. But I will fully acknowledge that, you know, I'm coming from certain privileges that not everyone has. And I'm grateful for those privileges, and because of those, I'm where I am. But I do think, you know, there's a lot of lessons that can be taken from this book and applied to most situations.
You mentioned that you'd read this book several times before you got down to actually revising it. When you go revise a book, you're actually now reading sentence by sentence. It's a much deeper dive than you probably did before. Was there anything that surprised you while you were writing and researching this revision? Did it change any of the ways you looked at some of these lessons or any of his messages?
Not really. It just, you know, it kind of highlighted how we've changed, if anything, from like 1920, like a book written in 1920, read in 2020, 2023 or later, it doesn't always read the same way, I'm sure. So there was times going through it, like I did find the language a little jarring. Again, it's most, and most of that is just gender. It was just the gender norms of the times, which, you know, for me now, it was a little irksome. But the core messages, the core stories, the core principles, no, even going line by line, like this is, I don't think I would have done this project if I hadn't already been very much in love with the book. And I still very much love this book.
Well, Clifton Corbin, I wanted to thank you very much for coming on. What I really gather from this conversation is the timelessness of these basic financial principles. And I think it's really easy for us as parents when we're trying to teach our children to get mired in the details. And certainly it's easy for us as we mature and grow up to think it's all too difficult or it's going to take too much time or it's someone else's responsibility. But by going back to The Richest Man in Babylon, I think what we really see is that there are these timeless messages about money. And if we incorporate them and think them, we're much more likely to get control of our finances. I want to end this episode the way I end every episode by asking you what is up next in your life and how people can reach out to you. So let's start first. What is coming up next for Clifton Corbin?
Well, I've got a few things on the go. I'm working on a workbook version of Your Kids, Their Money. I've had a few parents say they want to get a little deeper on the subject matter of my first book, so I'm working on that. Another project I'm working on is taking, again, Your Kids, Their Money and trying to apply it more to young folks who might have a bit of neurodiversity, so ADHD specifically. And I'm also working on a tabletop game. So, personal finance tabletop game. Hopefully it will make Monopoly less relevant. I'm joking about that, of course. But working on something there as well. So I'm working on that. And as far as where to find me, my website is probably the easiest place, and that's cliftoncorbin.com. If you go there, as we're talking about, you know, making things simple, if you go to cliftoncorbin.com/workbook, there's a free downloadable workbook, for kids to, you know, do some of that early money identification. There's some puzzles, there's some games. There's even like a little budgeting, activity in there for them. So it's again about those early principles. It's for kids between, you know, grade one and grade three. It's free to download. Again, that's cliftoncorbin.com/workbook. And I think it's a great, you know, early activity for kids to just start getting some of that money identification and learning some of these early financial literacy skills.
Well, the books are Your Kids, Their Money, as well as The Richest Man in Babylon, Revised for Modern Times. Clifton Corbin, thank you for coming on Earn and Invest today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That's a wrap.
Earn and Invest is now part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to this show as well as other fine podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Just another reminder, the Wealth with Purpose Mastermind/Patreon group to support Earn and Invest is starting. Our first meeting is going to be March 30th. To learn more, go to earnandinvest.com/mastermind. Again, that's earnandinvest.com/mastermind. Learn about the Wealth with Purpose Mastermind group, where we're going to talk about the concept of enough. How do we find a life of purpose? And last but not least, what do we do when we are ready to transition out of our jobs into something we like doing more than what we're currently doing in our 9-to-5? Check us out. I'd love for you to be part of the group. Yeah, that was, I mean, I loved rereading The Richest Man in Babylon. I mean, it was just, it just brings you back to the center of why we do all this. I mean, you know, we've all heard this, right? There are only a few main topics in personal finance that we find just interesting, more exciting, more relatable ways to talk about them. And you can go back to Clayson and realize this guy really had it together.
No, he nailed
it. He nailed it. And by reading some of these enjoyable parables, we can go back to like making it all manageable. Cause I think that's the problem, right? Is it just seems so unmanageable to most people for themselves. And then when you get into teaching their children, then it even seems more unmanageable. So it was really refreshing to go back and read it again.
Yeah, I think we, like you said, we've overcomplicated it. And then on top of that, we have this feeling like, well, it's not so much we have this feeling, we have this culture that's told us, you know, money's private, we don't talk about money, keep that to yourself. All of these things that keep money out of the discussion, keep finances out of the discussion. And then, well, then you're left trying to figure it out on your own. And then you go onto, you know, a website or what have you, and it's got all this complex jargon and all of these complicated methods of managing your money. And it's like, well, then you just tune out because, again, we have no time. So, yeah, I agree with you. Just go back to the basics.
Yeah, yeah. And how long did it take you to revise this?
Not that long, to be honest. The challenge was just finding time where my son and I could just hang out together. I got lucky. There was a few days in there where he was sick. So we just sat outside and I would do it with him. So it was kind of a blessing there. I don't know, probably about 2 to 3 months for me to go through it with him. And then another little bit of time for me just to go through it on my own. And then I, you know, flip it to my editor. I think having my editor took the longest piece of time, just because there's a lot of quotes within quotes within quotes, and it just gets really complicated really quickly. So that's part of the reason why I wanted my editor to take a look at it, because I knew I would mess that up. So I was like, I'll work on the words. You make sure the formatting and grammar is all right.
How cool was it for him to see his name as editor of a book?
So happy that when I told him that his name was going to be on it, he was through the moon, and he's 10, so he's got to play it cool. But as soon as the proofs came, and I was like, I had to look at the proof, but it's got proof written on it, and I was like, he's like, can I bring that to school? I was like, you don't want to wait for the final? He's like, no, I want to bring that one to school now. I was like, all right, bud, you can, you know, it's yours. So yeah, no, he's pretty excited about it. But now it's not a bad thing at all. But my daughter's like, when are we working on our book? And I was like, okay, well, so at some point she and I are going to have to collaborate.
You've roped yourself in now. So.
Oh yeah. But I'm okay with that. She's such a creative little mind. So I'm excited to see what could come out of her head.
Yeah. And it's a continuous, so from my standpoint, this question of how we educate our children is just about money is such a rich topic. I mean, I feel like people are always ready to talk about that and always lots of questions. It's a great conversation. So, I mean,
I think so.
Oh, I think it'll endure.
Yeah, I think so. To that point, that's why I started working on this game, because I realized, you know, a book is great, but if we really want to engage kids, and I've, you know, I love recommending kids books as well. I've got a bunch of recommendations on my website and I do it all the time. But I think if I can get a game that, you know, parents can play with their kids, Monopoly is great. I recommend that one all the time. But I think there's a lot of stuff that's missing in Monopoly that I would really like to get.
Much about game making?
So it's my first at bat at game making. I've already got the prototype done. I was actually just right before this, I was talking to a friend of mine who's done, I think he's done 3 games. He's kind of my mentor on this whole thing. And I was like, I'm ready for a play test with him now. So no, to answer your question, no, I do not. But I'm always, like I said, I'm always trying to learn more things. So.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.